Brian McLean on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome to the Brian McLean Show. Thank you for joining me today. We're going to kick off yet another week of media analysis over here on today's News Talk. Thank you once again for joining me. Another beautiful day out here in Central Texas, doing our best to chase down all that freedom we can find out here in Central Texas. Myself, as a California refugee, very glad to be out here in Texas instead of back there in California. And shout out to all my West Coast listeners out there dealing with it, living the life and paying the price out there. My goodness, the mass exodus continues out of California. They're running out of U-Haul trucks over there, folks. They're running out of U-Haul trucks. So if you got to do any of that moving stuff, well, make sure to leave yourself plenty of time to get those trucks all secured and all that stuff. Sounds like quite the mess. All right, let's see here. Calls for disbanding the FBI become more and more popular in the conservative circles right now after the raid at Mar-a-Lago. I found this clip pretty interesting. I think TNT Radio tweeted this one out. I captured it so you guys could hear it. Let's check this clip out.
People say, look, he issued orders, a lot of orders, declassifying information before he left office. Do you know anything about this?
As a former deputy director of national intelligence, I know how this system works. The president is the sole and universal arbiter and classification authority in the United States of America. If he says a document is declassified or a set of them, that is it. There is no written material required. That is a fiction being created by the fake news and the radical left. In October of 2020, President Trump put out for the world to see a sweeping declassification order, and he did it via social media. Every single Russiagate doc, every single Hillarygate doc, every one. Those are his words. That is the precedent that the president of the United States is allowed to operate under. And then in December and January on the way out, I witnessed him declassify whole sets of documents. So it is not incumbent upon President Trump and his lawyers and his and him as a target of this investigation to show he in fact did declassify them. It's up to the government, who has the burden of proof, who are trying to deprive a man of his liberty, to show that no such order was in fact given. They know they can't. So what happens? The fake news mafia comes in and says, oh, but there was no protocols followed. And Mark, you know, when they're arguing protocols and procedure, it's because they have lost the factual argument and the truth. And now they are trying to hide behind this magistrate judge who is going to supposedly play this game of redactions. We saw it in Russiagate. And when I was a deputy DNI, we lifted all those redactions from the Russiagate docs. And what do we see, Mark? Corruption. FBI and DOJ corruption and breaking of the law. That's the same game they're going to play here. And the fake news media is going to attempt to applaud them for their farce in terms of transparency. And we cannot allow them to do that. The president declassified documents. The government has failed to show that that did not occur. Procedure and protocol do not apply to the president of the United States when he is declassifying documents.
And let me underscore that point. The Constitution of the United States, the first sentence, Article 2, Section 1, the president is the executive branch. That's why everybody agrees he can declassify and classify as much as he wants, and he can do it right out the door. The Espionage Act, in this sense, simply does not apply to a former president. It does not apply to the president of the United States. It was passed originally in 1917. It was pushed by Woodrow Wilson to use against his enemies, people who opposed World War I. It was never, ever intended to apply to a president. Let me ask you this, Kash Patel. Barack Obama, George W. Bush, Clinton, Bill Clinton, Vice President Gore, Vice President Biden, Vice President Cheney. Do we know if any of them secreted any documents, took any documents with them to their homes, classified or otherwise? Do we know?
I know for a fact that President Obama has classified access at one of his homes, so those such documents exist there, and they should, as for former presidents of the United States, and that law and that rule should apply equally. But the Government Services Administration is responsible for packaging and parceling those documents, and you bring up a great point. They were the ones that moved the documents to Mar-a-Lago, and they were the ones that have now admitted they mistakenly moved boxes. It's not like President Trump. Even if they get past the declassification farce, it's a ruse, I should say, it's not not like President Trump, put him in a backpack and moved him down there and said, nothing to see here. I want to illegally distribute these documents. The law should be applied. There not should be a two-tiered system of justice. Clinton, Obama, Bush, Trump, as former presidents, must be treated equally when it comes to classified documentation.
I think it's very interesting that not a single former president or vice president have opened their mouths, because I suspect they have taken documents with them, whether it's in violation, quote unquote, of one law or another. This entire event was completely unnecessary, and it's just more of an effort to try and trap and drag down Donald Trump. Cash Patel.
All right. There you go. That was Mark Levin talking to Cash Patel there. And yeah, very interesting stuff. Very interesting stuff. No wonder people are starting to finally wake up and say, wait a minute, we're just starting to see a pattern here with the way the federal agencies and the DOJ are being used as political battering rams. For a complete list of shows and our schedule offered at TNT Radio, simply visit our website at tntradio.live. We serve up the latest live news and current affairs presented by a host of credible and expert commentators who can separate fact from fiction and truth from propaganda right here on TNT Radio.
Your trusted news source.
Something you just can't question.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
All right, my next guest is the author of Shattered Lives. He's an advocate on counterterrorism and national security. Joseph Connor has testified before the Senate Subcommittee on Foreign Relations regarding President Clinton's 1999 clemency grant to 16 terrorists whose FALN murdered his father, Frank Connor. His name is Joseph Connor. Welcome, Joseph. How are you?
Good, Brian. How are you? Thanks for having me.
Oh, I'm great. I really appreciate you taking the time to join the show over here at TNT. First, give us a little bit of context and maybe tell us the story of what happened to your father, Frank.
My dad was 33 years old. He was a first-generation American, brought up in working class Washington Heights in New York City, married my mom, had a couple of kids, and what would have been my ninth birthday party. He went to work, as he did every day, at the Morgan Bank. He got a job out of high school. His mother was a cleaning lady there. She got him the job, and he went to college at night. And he went out for lunch with clients on January 24th, 1975. And he walked into Francis Tavern, which is where George Washington bid farewell to his officers after the Revolutionary War. It's where the Sons of Liberty met. It's where American freedom was founded in a lot of ways. And it's where the Puerto Rican terrorist FALN walked a bomb in and placed it behind the table where he and his colleagues were sitting. Within a few minutes, the bomb detonated. It was an extraordinarily powerful bomb. It shook the entire canyons of Wall Street. It murdered my father instantly. It killed three others and wounded 60 people. Set forth that was going to be the night that I celebrated my ninth birthday. My brother's 11th. I was born January 20th, and that was the 24th. So it was a Friday, and my dad was murdered. We did the best to pick up our lives at the time, and over the years, the terrorists were caught mainly in Chicago. They were arrested. They were tried in Chicago. They wouldn't accept the United States as having jurisdiction over them, so they refused to testify at their own trials. They were convicted, sentenced to 55, 65, 75 years in prison. Judge McMillan at trial said he would have executed them if he had the chance. And so they all went to jail for an awfully long time. They were supposed to be in jail for a long time until the Clintons in 1999 offered the most of them clemency when Hillary was running for senator from New York in order to try to connect her with the Latino community in New York. There was one terrorist, William Morales, who escaped, who was caught after he blew himself up in his Queens bomb factory in 1977. And 1978, it would have been my dad's 37th birthday, July 12th. And he ends up escaping from prison and ends up in Cuba, where he is today. And one of our efforts is to have him returned where he belongs, to face his 89 years New York State, 10-year federal sentence. So there's been a lot with the clemencies. Because of that, I've testified a couple of times at the Senate Judiciary Committee, including at Eric Holder's AG confirmation hearing in 2009, about his role in the clemencies. And, you know, also just as an aside, well, not exactly as an aside, 2 years to the day, really, after the terrorists left prison in 1999, my cousin Steve, who's my dad's godson, he was murdered on 9/11. And, you know, I was in the Trade Center that morning and saw the planes hit. So as a result, I've, you know, we've been involved in a couple of major instances of terrorism. I went to Guantanamo Bay a few years ago and faced one of the FALN members, Oscar Lopez, who refused the Clinton clemency at his parole hearing in Terre Haute, Indiana, in 2011. So we've been very involved in the anti-terror, counter-terror as an advocate, and really working hard to provide justice for my father and for other families who've been through such horrific events.
Absolutely amazing. I'm sorry to hear about all your family's involvement as regards to the losses that you've suffered over this. I can see why you must be so inspired to do what you do. So that's pretty amazing. What's the deal with the Clintons there? Like, why the clemency? Was this strictly for winning votes, or was there something more to it?
Well, you know what? It's really a great question. And there's a lot to it. If, you know, I guess we have a few minutes, so I can kind of get into a little detail.
Yeah, sure. We do. I'll look for a break at around 20 minutes past the hour. We take a few breaks, but yeah, take your time.
Perfect. In 1999, if you recall, Hillary Clinton was gearing up to run against Giuliani for senator from New York. She was a carpetbagger. She had no connection to New York. So there was a, simultaneously, there was a group of leftists within the organization, within the Clintons, looking to get clemency for these FALN terrorists. They were never convicted of the Francis bombing, but they were put away for 80 years in Chicago. And you know, the economics of law enforcement would, you know, really call for that. They were put away for basically for life. There was no need to bring them back to New York to face another trial. There was no death penalty in New York, so there would it would have been concurrent sentences. So the Clintons put a phony narrative out there that these were nonviolent terrorists, and there was a deal cut within Jose Serrano and Nidia Vasquez and others, Luis Gutierrez in the Hispanic community in New York and in Chicago, with the Clintons basically trading votes for clemency. Now, you know, we never really thought about the monetary aspect of it at the time. Was there money? Did money did they also get paid off, the Clintons? And, you know, who knows? I don't know that. But there was a there was a interesting similar deal that the Clintons cut. Around that same time, there was a Hasid community, or still is, in upstate New York. It's called New Square, New York. There, in that election, when Hillary ran for senator, they voted like 99.9% for Hillary Clinton. It was like the whole town. So there was an investigation into that. Would the at the same time, the Clintons gave clemency to two members of the Hasid community there. And in exchange, they got those votes. Now, there was an investigation done by the FBI at the time, and the Clintons were exonerated by, guess who? James Comey. So it's not unprecedented. There's two instances of the Clintons selling votes or clemency for votes. And they also, if you remember Mark Rich, they sold clemency for money. So, you know, I wouldn't put anything past them. You know, I was listening to your to the news that was going on before this and, you know, talking about the idea that the declassification of documents. Well, like the declassification of documents, which is it's an exact power of the president, an unchecked power of the president, so was clemency. And, you know, at the time we tried to get the Clintons to explain why they offered clemency. They claimed executive privilege. They wouldn't talk about it. And we even introduced a bill called the Pardon Attorney Reform and Integrity Act to the Congress to get some rules around clemency, and it was rejected under constitutional grounds. So the point that I'm making there is that the clemency, like the declassification that we're talking about today, is an unchecked power, one that Clinton used, and then Obama gave clemency to Oscar Lopez Rivera, who refused the Clinton clemency in 1999. Both were absolutely cynical, politically driven, just slaps in the face to all the American people, but they were unchecked powers of a president. And now I'm seeing that Trump is being called that he didn't have the power to declassify, when of course he did, in exactly the same way that Clinton and Obama had the power to offer clemency without a check. So I think wow. There's a lot of parallels, and this story keeps coming back because there's so much that is still going on today.
Right. Wow. Thank you for that context there. That really adds a lot. I'm going to take a quick station break and we'll pick up right where we left off. You're listening to TNT, everybody.
You should hear what Michael Parker is talking about.
I guess we're not through with the flus. Now they're talking about the tomato flu. And I saw some photos of this thing, and apparently it's emerging in India. To me, it kind of looked like chicken pox, which immediately made me suspicious, because monkeypox, chicken pox, smallpox, shingles, all of these various things. But it's rising in kids in India, and it says that it was first identified on May 6th. They're saying that it's quite contagious. So far, it's infected 82 children, all under the age of 5. This is according to Lancet Respiratory Medicine Journal. And they think that also 26 other kids are suspected of having this tomato flu. Now, I'd never heard of this thing, and I guess they call it that because of these red blisters on the skin. It does look like chicken pox to me. I mean, as much as it's been a long time since I've had chicken pox, but that's kind of what it reminded me of. And so now I guess we're going to have to look out for that. And they call it sometimes tomato fever, tomato flu. The rare viral infection is in an endemic state. Ah, that sounds like monkeypox, because monkeypox was endemic in Africa and was not an issue for a long, long time.
The program and Michael Parker on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Affordable housing, we can build that. Sustainable housing, we can build that. At MIT Modular, we understand the importance of housing for all and the importance of design, cost, and functionality. Our goal is to meet the needs of our growing population by converting shipping containers to livable units. If you're like-minded and in a position to invest in something meaningful and life-changing, we want to hear from you. We are a team of professional architects, engineers, and financial and tax experts dedicated to offering unique solutions that provide a brighter future. Our Opportunity Zone Fund offers investors both real estate and operating business diversification, 5-year tax deferral on capital gains, annual tax benefits, and ultimately tax-free appreciation potential. There are Opportunity Zones all over America. If you're interested in learning more about our services, need affordable housing, or want to participate in creating a new vision for tomorrow, give us a call in the U.S. on 385-985-5702. Or read more at mitmodular.com. MIT Modular. We can build that.
Bad government, climate change alarmists, vaccine mandates. The threats to your freedom are many, but that's where we can help.
Hear more truths.
TNT Radio.
All the time.
Our truth shall set you free. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to the Brian McLean Show. I'm joined by Joseph Connor, author of Shattered Lives, and we're talking about the federal government talking about the presidency here, the executive powers, such as the ability to grant clemency, such as the ability to declassify documents. And this is all very disturbing, because when I compare, you know, everything we're talking about here, and I compare it to, say, President Trump granting a pardon to Paul Manafort, who joined me last week and talked about his new book. And you heard it in the clip too, this is becoming a bit of a bumper sticker statement right now. He was talking about the two-tier justice system. So it sounds to me very much like a two-tier justice system. And when I compare the Trump thing to what you're talking about there, the Clintons claimed executive privileges to, they don't have to say why they granted clemency to any of these people. But with Trump, with regards to Paul Manafort, we all knew, the public knew why he pardoned Paul Manafort, because there was nothing but corruption and lies and process crimes that were used to put him in prison. I mean, it was blatantly obvious what happened, and he's written a book about it now. So, I mean, this idea of a two-tiered system is really scary.
Yeah, I don't know if there's even a second tier. It seems like it's a one-tiered system where it's all on one side.
It's the heads we win, tails you lose paradigm.
Yeah. I mean, seriously, I mean, you look at what's going on, and you know, you have someone like Clinton and then Obama having these terrorists and in prison, put away, and then releasing them for political reasons. I mean, as I testified at Holder's confirmation here, because just to give a little context on Holder, he was deputy attorney general under Clinton, and Clinton charged him when they were looking to release these guys with, and girls, because it was both. He charged Holder with coming up with an option, a reason for him to do it. See, although it's an unchecked power of the president, Clinton is also a very political person, like the rest, like everyone. He wanted something that he could come out and argue, this is why he did it, right? So he goes to Holder, and Holder goes to the pardon attorney, Margaret Love, and he says, you know, we'd like you to justify our releasing these terrorists. And she says, no. There's no justification. The FBI is against their release. The Department of Justice otherwise is against their release. The Bureau of Prisons is against their release. They've not even requested clemency. As a matter of fact, the FALN would never ask for clemency. They didn't even look for it. So she says no. So Holder fired her. And then he got a guy named Christian Adams, and he did the same rigmarole with Adams. Now, Adams came up with an options memo that was like, okay, well, you could leave them in prison, you could release them, you could give them full pardon, or you can give them clemency. Clinton kind of latched onto that, and he ends up giving them the clemency, and he used the options memo as sort of a justification. But when we went down to testify in 99, in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee, he wouldn't allow anyone from the Department of Justice to speak at all. It was executive privilege. No one was allowed to discuss it. So when Eric Holder then was nominated for Attorney General by Obama, I was invited by the Republican Party to go down and explain what his role was in all of this, which I did. You could find the testimony on my website, wewinamerica.com. But then, of course, out of the 40 Republican senators at the time, like 20 voted for him anyway, or 19 voted for him anyway. So, you know, they put him through. But as I said, at that point, anyone who would release unrepentant terrorists, because you have to remember, the FALN didn't request the clemency. As a matter of fact, they were given 30 days to talk about it from prison to prison to decide as a group whether they were going to accept the clemency. So they didn't, once they were offered it, they didn't even accept it. They turned it down initially. And the Justice Department at the time was pushing it on them. Finally, on September 10th, 1999, they accepted clemency, with the exception of Oscar Lopez, who refused the clemency, and they all left jail. And so that was Eric Holder's role in this. And I actually confronted Holder at a meeting unrelated to this in D.C. a couple of years ago when I happened to see him, and I asked him why he would ever release terrorists. And of course, he says, well, they were in jail for unusually long terms. They were in jail for 17 years for being terrorists, and they were sentenced to 55 to 70 years. So that was a completely bogus reason. And then he just sort of walked away. So we have a government right now, and it's been quite some time, I guess, that is unresponsive to the American people, that is not interested in the safety of the American people, but right now only looks to maintain its power and grow its power over the American people. That's what I have gotten out of this, because I've been there, and you know, it's really difficult to deal with sometimes.
Oh yeah, and you know, I think as more and more stories like yours emerge and sort of solidify, because it's like everything happens so fast, it's really hard to keep up with what's happening right now, because they're quite literally propagandizing us, lying to us, gaslighting us, shaming us into not having discussions like this. And it's just caused a complete mess, and everybody's trying to keep up with the latest thing. So I appreciate you being here to sort of add some context to these things, because if we don't stop and look backwards a little bit and start to see the patterns that lead to the current information blitz that we're experiencing and the propaganda and the dialectic narratives and all that, then we're screwed. We won't have the context to perform as an American public properly if we don't have this context. And I have to take a break here, but I'll get your thoughts on that on the other side of a quick bottom of the hour break with today's news talk.
This is James O'Neill with a check of today's headlines. A federal judge is giving the Justice Department until next Thursday to submit a redacted version of its affidavit laying out justification for last week's search of Mar-a-Lago for classified documents. Billions of Apple users are urged to update their devices after the firm disclosed serious security vulnerabilities for iPhones, iPads, and Macs that could potentially allow attackers to take complete control of them.
Are you enjoying listening to TNT Radio?
Do you think we're doing a good job?
Then please let us know. Why not leave us a like or a positive review or comment on Facebook, Gab, or Getter? Help us get the word out as we cover the biggest topics of our time on today's news talk, TNT Radio.
That's right. That's where you do it. TNTradio.live. This is the Brian McClain Show. I'm joined by Joseph Connor, author of Shattered Lives, and clearly an advocate for getting this country back on track and holding people accountable for the wrong things that they've done. Joseph, over to you. What do you think about that? Just that idea of how important these kind of books and conversations are, so that we can actually look in the rearview mirror, and we don't have to look very far, folks. We're not talking about ancient history here. We're not talking about J. Edgar Hoover. We're talking about stuff that has happened in a short span of time, and it's compounding now, I would say.
Yeah, look, I think your point before was well taken. I think we're drinking out of a fire hose at this point. Like, they're just throwing so much in our faces every day. Once you kind of get your head around one of the issues, the next one comes up. And that's absolutely done intentionally. It's to saturate the American people with just too much. You know, you start focusing on, you know, in my case, clemency or 9/11 or what happens to be the, but then it can be the impeachment, the second impeachment, the war, the raiding the Trump house, you know, just one thing after another, inflation, you know, the virus. I mean, it's just boom, 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 these major things, but also everyday little crappy things that distract people from really focusing on, and then you got to live your life, right? So the more chafe they throw at us, the more we have to adjust our lives, right? Taxes have gone up, right? Now I got to figure out how I'm going to deal with that. And now I got to get, you know, I'm going to have less money, and I have to do something about my car. I have to do something about my kids going to college. Whether they're going to, now are they going to, you know, forgive debt? Who's going to do, like, it's just nonstop. And most people, you know, I just was watching the news before, and the headline on the news was that some show on HBO streaming crashed. That's what people are starting to care about. That's what they want people to care about. A show on the big deal is a show on HBO crashing instead of the inflation going rampant, instead of the ESG becoming a major part in our lives, instead of our government not, you know, prosecuting terrorism and allowing $80 billion of weapons to fall in the hands of the Taliban. So, you know, this is what has come to. We've been sort of immune, like numb. And the more crap they throw at us, the more they are immune to the very crap that they're throwing. It needs to slow down. And, you know, about 10 years ago, a buddy of mine, Mike Duncan, and I wrote a book. We called it The New Founders. And we brought the American founding fathers to life in it was 2012. It doesn't feel that long ago, but that's a decade ago. But we used the Constitution and the Federalist Papers and the letters that they wrote to each other to kind of make a story about what they would do today in today's world, not a lecture, but actually a story. And using the constitutional foundation and principles, because it's all there. We can fix this. We just have to go back to our constitutional standards, to our original beliefs. And the more we stray from that, the more insane it gets. And that's what we're seeing now.
Oh, yeah, I completely agree. I mean, the way out is back. It's got to be back. It's sort of a combination of back and forward, because we have the technology to do amazing things if we use it right, if we wrestle it out of the hands of these creeps in Silicon Valley who are participating in this at the same or maybe even a worse level as some of the federal agencies and corrupt elements of the government, you know, the executive branch, the legislative branch. Like, this, we just need to roll this stuff back big time, big time. I have a candidate for Senate coming up later in the show who's got a great platform for that. I've talked to multiple candidates for representative and Senate who have great ideas, you know, about how we can do exactly that. And it start with really simple things like, you know, number one, stop letting the government print money. Just quit all printing right now. All of it needs to stop, you know, and then we need to start audits and declassifications. You know, it's really easy. Roll back laws that are redundant or illegible because they're 10,000 pages of globalese and legalese that no one can read.
And then we got to get our school kids. You know, we used to kind of just kind of say, oh God, our kids are so uneducated. But the fact is that our school kids don't understand what the principles of this country are. So when you're rudderless, when you don't have God in your lives, like so many of them don't, when you don't have the principles of where we're going, as George Harrison said, if you don't know where you're going, any road will take you there. And that's kind of what's going on here. We don't know where we're going. And so we go in any direction. And I think it starts with our kids. You know, when you start talking the Constitution with them, their eyes glaze over. They don't even know what you're talking about. So how can they, you know, how can they know where we need to be as a country when they're not educated? And, you know, when they're talking transgender in classrooms rather than, you know, the Constitution or the Declaration or, you know, civics. It's a really major problem, and it's intentional. This stuff didn't just happen by happenstance. It's coordinated. You know, and I hate to be dire because I'm really not the kind of a person, but you know, when you think about it, we really have gone in a very, very bad trajectory. And I think God is a big deal. I think we need to bring God, restore religion and God in our lives, and know that there is a greater power than us. Because if not, then government becomes the power.
Oh yeah. There's such a vacuum there that government has taken over, and it's not just government. It's the fact, and you know, it's not to be dire. It's not to be dire because, like you said, there is a way out. We just need to realize that it's not conspiracy theory to point out the fact that cultural engineering has seeped into our entertainment industry, our political realm and our education system so much so, and with so much purpose, that it is taking apart and just taking away everything that was anything resembling traditional. I mean, between, like you said, the deletion of the founding principles and the history, the actual history of the country, it's been replaced with critical race theory. It's been replaced with this idea that the entire history of the country is that of systemic racism and terribleness, right. And it's one particular racist problem that did all this. And then you introduce the whole wokeism stuff, all that garbage. Yeah. And then you do the sexual manipulation stuff on the kids in school. And to top that off, this is the worst part to me, Joseph. And I think it's
just call me Joe, by the way.
Okay, great, Joe. So I think it's understated the magnitude of what I call the Black Mirror prawn phenomenon. And by that, I'm talking about hardcore pornography available on a tiny pocket-sized device like an iPhone that all adolescent kids have access to now. So it's like they get this stuff inserted in their heads in school. They get it inserted in their heads in the media. And then they have this thing in their pocket where they can see the most depraved stuff that they could possibly imagine when they're in their developmental phases. And you create a new kind of person that we've never seen before. We've never seen people that have had access to something like that while being stuck in a feedback loop.
And they're told that it's fine. And they're celebrated, right? I mean, it's not that you're just like, you know, seeing it, you know, hiding your Playboys under your, you know, in the back of your bed. It's celebrated. This stuff is great. So, like, you know, it's we've gone so backwards. And, you know, some of the things, like when we celebrate stuff, like, it just reminded me of, you know, the January 6th stuff, right? So now you have Americans who protested, rioted, whatever you want to call it. And they've been called terrorists, right? And it's been said that this is the worst thing that's happened to America since the Civil War. On the attack on the Capitol. But what they failed to mention in the media is that the Capitol was attacked by Puerto Rican terrorists twice in the 1950s, excuse me. When it came to the FALN, they had terrorists in prison for 70 years, real terrorists, real people who were charged and convicted of seditious conspiracy, the very charge that they're trying to charge these people at the Capitol with, who built bombs and blew it up and were coordinated by Cuba and financed by them. And then they let them out of prison for political reasons. So, you know, and the reality of what they've done now with they've attacked American citizens, and maybe they did the wrong thing by going in the Capitol. It's very unclear to me what really happened, but these weren't terrorists. These weren't seditionists. The left knows what seditionists are. They know what terrorists are, and they had them in jail and they let them out. And you know what that does to like a family like ours, to have that feeling that the people that killed my dad, they are to be let out because they're great people, but the American people who would protest against it are now the ones that they're calling terrorists, or the school. Well, the school board, the parents who go to the school board members who are fighting for their kids to have a decent education, they're terrorists too. But the ones who murdered my dad, oh, they're not terrorists. They should be let out. So, I mean, it's so personal, as you can tell. And it's for me and my family, it's not exactly a, you know, a theoretical exercise. It's reality, and you know we face this every day. So I just want, you know, it would be good if your audience could kind of take that away, that, you know, it's not necessarily, it is theory in a lot of ways, but the theory affects people directly, and just people just like them. We are no different from anyone else in America.
Yeah, and it's getting down to the point now, Joe, where it's all about, it's about speech, you know, it's not, they're trying to, we do have to be a little bit dire here because it's gotten so bad. Look over in Germany right now, for example, with regards to social media and political prisoners, they've labeled, okay, so there's a independent journalist there, former mainstream journalist named Oliver Yannick, and Oliver's been very vocal about standing up against corruption, against pandemic lockdowns, against all kinds of stuff. He's been very critical of the German government. Well, Germany has its own online hate speech laws, and they've essentially made it illegal to criticize the government to a certain muddy extent. And if they decide you've criticized them, well, they can arrest you for hate speech. So he left Germany. I think he was in the Philippines or something like that. And they had that government arrest him and then extradited him back and are now charging him with all this hate speech stuff. And this is, Germany is essentially a vassal state. It's an occupied state of the United States. It has been since World War II. And the fact that we go around claiming that we're fighting for democracy everywhere, like, oh, that's what we're doing in Syria, guys, right? Well, you've got a vassal state of ours over there where they're just letting this happen. They're actually promoting this to happen. And I would argue that that's the canary in the coal mine right there for us. That's where we're all headed as Americans. And once that they universalize those online laws, we're not even going to be able to have conversations like this without getting, you know, swatted probably. So that's why this is dire for everybody.
Yeah. You know, you're right. It's kind of like it's the test case, right? And it has gone on. I mean, you see the connection between government and industry where, you know, people will lose their jobs if they say the wrong thing. So, you know, we are in that area right now, which I never thought, like sometimes I think back at my dad, you know, he died in 75 and I don't know that he'd even recognize this country in a lot of ways anymore for the lack of freedoms that we have to be careful about everything we say. And God, comedians can't even make a joke. They'll lose their livelihood. I mean, it's pretty scary. I think it's up to our next generation and us. I mean, I'm 50. What am I, 56 now? But it's up to my generation, but the next ones too, to start really appreciating what our liberty is about. Because, you know, Reagan said we're one generation from its extinction. And, he was totally right about that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's pretty scary. We've just got federal agencies running amok here, FBI, DOJ, NSA, CIA, DOE, come up with any alphabet soup probably. And there's an unknown percentage of necessity for that entity anymore to do anything other than hold up a system of absolute corruption and lies and theft that's now totally falling apart. As you know, they polarized us so much over between I'd say 2015 and now, like it was major during Trump years, and then we had COVID, and then it just became the way that they roll. Everything is polarizing. Every single thing is polarizing. Our names are polarizing. Our Twitter descriptions are polarizing. It's like we're immediately discounted by people as soon as we just look for that reason to discount other people. And it's like, what do we even do at this point to break that back down? I mean, all I can think to do is just do what we're doing right here. You know, I try to get three of these in every day so that we can just build more and more context for the listeners out there, because they need to understand stories like yours. I mean, people are sitting in jail right now for J6. I like you pointed out, I want to underline that. There's over 100 people sitting in jail right now for J6. There's 70-something-year-old grandmas with cancer being put in prison cells right now for showing up on those stairs and having the Capitol Police move those ropes aside and invite them in to take selfies, while someone like Joe here has had his family impacted not once but twice in a major way, and those people are just allowed to be let go, you know? So this something is very rotten here, Joe.
Yeah, you know, that you know, one of the things we've been trying to do, or I've been trying to do, is bring back one of these terrorists from Cuba. And for the first time now, we have a little bit of bipartisan support for that, which gives you a little bit of hope, where we have Marco Rubio and Robert Menendez joining forces to introduce a bill called the Warrant Trooper Warner Forster and Frank Connor Justice Act to call for the government to bring back these terrorists from Cuba. So, you know, you look for little victories, and you know that's one that I think we have a good chance for. And on my website, like I said, it's wewinamerica.com, but and I'm at Joseph F. Connor on Twitter. But I mean, there's a lot. I would really ask your audience to contact their congressmen and senators to push for this act to be passed in a bipartisan way, where we do actually have a little bit of cohesion between our, you know, the bipolar country that we live in. And you know, maybe we can make a difference there. And you know, that's been a tough one, trying to get people to focus on something that's easy, right? I mean, who's going to fight bringing back terrorists? But you know, there's always I get attacked. I've been attacked on social media by, you know, being a right wing, not making money off my father's death. And I'll say Ralph Cramden from The Honeymooners made more money than I have, you know, publishing a few articles here and there. And even the book Shattered Lives that I wrote, you know, it's really was written for my family. So they'll know, you know, what we've been through, and people can understand it. It's great when people read it and get an appreciation. And, but really that was really written to document my dad and kind of celebrate him so that he wouldn't be forgotten. We actually have a documentary movie almost complete, by the same name, which we hope to get out, and maybe people will get a feel for the struggles that just a very average American family has been through. Because if it could happen to us, it can definitely happen to anybody else. mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like we're first generation American, and you know, without much means, but at least enough gumption to fight. And that's what we've done.
Yeah, you know, the of course they're gonna accuse you of trying to make money, this and that. It amazes me. People think people like yourself and me are driving Bentleys out here and making all kinds of money by saying such unpopular things.
I know. It's crazy. Like, dude, you know, it probably cost me, I don't know how many hundreds of thousands of dollars in time and energy and everything else, but you know, I have a family of my own, and you know, had to send kids to college that cost an absolute fortune, and done all the things everyone else has. Plus, trying to fight the freaking government, man. Like that's, you know. Anyway, that's what I chose to do, and that's my business, and you know, I didn't have to do it, but I did.
Well, and, your story needs to be heard, man. I'm really glad you joined us on the show today, because I wasn't familiar with it until I started reading about it this morning and talking to you, and it just adds another piece of the puzzle. Like I was saying, I repeat this all the time, but context leads to a worldview that represents something close to reality. And these people, these mirage men of the Fortune 100 and the banking societies and the government and all this, like they and Hollywood, they have completely pull the wool over our eyes about what's going on in our system and where and when we should be allowed to be hesitant and skeptical without being considered just whack job conspiracy people. When we have all this context, you know, it's not a conspiracy when context.
You know, I think I'd like to say, like, you know, after 9/11, where, you know, I was intimately connected with that, and then, why didn't we connect the dots? Well, you know, we are connecting the dots now, and the dots are one thing after another is happening. whether, you know, we're being locked down, or this COVID, or the injections, they see how far they can push the populace, and, you know, then gun control and all the rest of this crap. So, you know, they keep pushing it, and that's the connection of the dots. If you don't see a trend there, then you're just not looking, and or you're willfully ignorant. And I think, like I alluded to that HBO thing, because that's what people are. It's like the, you know, what did Marx say, the opiate of the people? He called religion, but that's what we've gotten here. Where we, you know, you get so you get tired of it, man. It gets exhausting. And, you know, you want to watch a game or you want to watch HBO or something. And then that doesn't happen. And then you get, and then that becomes a big story. So we're a distracted society. And, you know, it's hard to get your head, around it sometimes, but, anyway, I've probably preached enough, but,
No, not at all. Not at all. I love it. It's absolutely great. So what, in a nutshell, we've got about 5 minutes left. In a nutshell, expand on, you can't say in a nutshell when you're going to talk about 9/11, but tell me a little bit more about what happened on 9/11 with your family.
Yeah, sure. You know, I commuted through the Trade Center that day, like with my brother, as I did every day. I started working in downtown in 1988 on September 10th, 1988. So it was just like 13 years. And my cousin Steve, he was a bond trader for Cantor Fitzgerald. And it's funny because the night before September 10th, it was the 2-year anniversary of the release of the FALN terrorists. And I brought my laptop home and I just wanted to start writing a book about what had happened. And I left work early at a doctor's appointment and I knew I'd see my cousin Steve. Like I say, he was a bond trader. He was always on an early train and he always had beers and he was going to make me have beers. I'm like, look, I want to write. I don't want to have a couple of beers and then go to a doctor's appointment. That, you know, that doesn't work. So I purposely avoided seeing him on the train. And the next day I commuted in with my brother. Beautiful day. Like, unbelievable day. You know, I commuted through the Hoboken and then the path into the Trade Center. I left the Trade Center probably about 8:30 and I was at my desk at 60 Wall Street when the side of the North Tower exploded and I looked out and I saw the flames rip out of the building and what looked to me like a giant air conditioner kind of tumbled through. And I yelled, it was a bomb. And a friend of mine said, no, a plane. It was a plane. Plane came down the city. And I'm like, a big plane? He's like, no, it was like a 727. I'm like, 727? No one flies those anymore. I'm such a geek. And so I'm like, it couldn't have been a plane. I mean, it's a beautiful day. So I try to call Steve. And he like I said, he worked at Cantor. And I didn't get him on the phone. I left him a voicemail. And I wasn't really sure, you know, what was going on at that point. He was on the 104th floor. And then I called my brother. I couldn't get him. I called home and it was my daughter's first day of pre-K. No one was home. And then when I got my brother on the phone, right about 9 o'clock, I saw the second building explode out the window again. And, you know, then we knew it was terrorism. So, yeah, I ended up going on the street. You know, I left the building. We didn't know if there were other planes headed our way. We were right by the New York Stock Exchange. Who knew what was next? And I ended up meeting my brother on the street and a woman that I worked with. We happened to see her and we went into a church in Little Italy. And when we came out, they said that the towers had collapsed.
Wow.
Long story short, I got home that day and ended up at my cousin's house. And drove his car home from the train station. It was the same train station that my father parked at the day he was murdered, the Radburn train station in New Jersey. And I drove his car home and he was a lot taller than me, but I wouldn't change the station on the radio. I wouldn't move the seat. So I sort of drove home like the only one on the road, it felt like. You know, so his family, he had two wife and two little kids at the time. And, you know, and his parents, it's just one of those, you know, even when I think about it all these years later, it's very emotional. And then I went to Guantanamo Bay as a family member and sat in the courtroom with Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, laughing and taunting some of the family members. And I think about how we went to war against Al-Qaeda after 9/11. And in the case of my dad, we released the terrorists. And it does show the dichotomy between the way that we've treated various terror groups, left-wing terrorists like the FALN, who were Marxist Cubans, Cuban-inspired Puerto Ricans. They were let off the hook. And, you know, I believe we need to fight all terrorists whether they're Islamic or Irish or Puerto Rican, whatever they would be. But anyway, so that's the 9/11. And, you know, Steve's family has survived. They've really had a tough time of it. And his father died about 2 years ago, Don. And you know, like any other family, we've kind of stayed together the best we could and try to make the best of it. And we never forget. And I always add to that, but you always have to do something. Forgetting is not enough. That's just not enough.
Yep. There you go. Thank you so much, Joe. Your story is amazing. Please keep telling it. It's important that people understand what happened in your family, and keep up the advocacy. And I'll have you back on the show. I want to talk to you more. That's Joseph Connor. Joe Connor, everybody, author of Shattered Lives. Go pick that up. It's going to be amazing. And pick up New Founders also, another one of his books. And visit him at wewinamerica.com. We'll be right back.